From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Politics Day here on The Exchange. This hour, Christine O'Donnell's I'm Not a Witch ad and what goes into creating a political image. With Rahm Emanuel leaving the White House, we'll ask about the role of a president's chief of staff. Also, should a church in Sioux City lose its tax-exempt status for preaching politics from the pulpit? And Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie rallies conservative activists here in Iowa. Is Christie testing the waters for 2012? Joining us today, Iowa State University Professor of Political Science Stephen Schmidt. Also, New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Tell us what's on your political mind this hour. It starts right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Day here on The Exchange. On Wednesdays, we like to chew over the recent political developments, get some analysis, and have a chance for you to tell us what's on your political mind. Today, we want to talk about Christine O'Donnell's I'm Not a Witch ad and what goes into creating a political image. With Rahm Emanuel leaving the White House, we'll ask about the role of a president's chief of staff. Also, should a church in Sioux City lose its tax-exempt status for preaching politics from the pulpit? And Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie rallies conservative activists here in Iowa. Is Christie testing the waters for 2012? Joining us today to chew over these and other items, Iowa State University Professor of Political Science Stephen Schmidt. Good afternoon to you, Stephen.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Joining us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames. Also joining us by phone, New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson.
It's been a long time, Stephen. Hi, Ben.
Yes,
hey,
hi.
Great to have you both with us on the show. Again, I want to start off by talking about the one particular and curious ad that made news this week in the world of politics, and then ask the two of you about its effectiveness and then the keys to crafting a candidate's image in the public eye. Delaware Republican Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell has responded to a clip of her from 1999 on Politically Incorrect, in which she explained how she had dabbled in witchcraft with this ad.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you. None of us are perfect, but none of us can be happy with what we see all around us. Politicians who think spending, trading favors, and backroom deals are the ways to stay in office. I'll go to Washington and do what you'd do. I'm Christine O'Donnell, and I approve this message.
Okay. According to her website, Christine O'Donnell has raised more than $280,000 to run this ad statewide. Arnie Arneson, it's your neck of the woods out there. Let's start with you. How effective do you think this is? A good idea, or should she have better just waited for the witch comet to hopefully fade away?
Well, if you're referring to the sassy girl that you hate to love, who's one hip woman. Now, I'm quoting Ben Affleck, Al Franken, and James Carville, and they're all referring to Christine O'Donnell. You know what's amazing about the ad? Not that it has a Halloween theme, and I really need to thank her as a parent because I just love it when my politics and my holidays blend.
Right.
But that ad said absolutely nothing. Nothing. I'm like you. What's that about? I'm like me how? I'm like me in the morning, I'm like me at night, I'm like me when I'm employed, I'm like me when I'm unemployed. What is that? I mean, it is so remarkable that people were willing to commit more dollars for her to run something that is so incredibly simplistic, says nothing, puts a mirror up to the world and says, whatever you want me to be, I'm you.
Okay, Stephen, is that your take on this? What do you have to add?
When you run an ad that says, I am not a witch, it implies that your opponent is a witch. So this creates a really difficult situation, you know, in a political race, because now Christine O'Donnell's opponent is going to have to come out and say, well, I'm not a witch either, you know, and then it turns into essentially an empty discussion. But you know, the truth of the matter is that by confronting the issue, which was for her, you know, having said, you know, that, you know, she sort of in high school had some friends who were witches and that, you know, it was high school stuff.
Had a date on it that ended on a satanic altar as well.
On a satanic altar, which most of us have had experiences in high school where we ended up on a satanic altar. But
I've had five.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And it was usually the principal's office, you know, that we referred to that way. But for Christine O'Donnell, she had to get that sort of out of the way. And if nothing else, the ad is what Calvin Klein always said, which is there's no such thing as bad publicity because it's been played by everyone. Everyone Googles it. We're talking about it. So it's gotten massive free media, and beyond the cost of the ad itself, Christine O'Donnell has now got, you know, $3 billion worth of exposure from it. And a lot of people kind of blow it off and don't care. She looks much better. They've done a comb over. They've changed her clothes from Sarah Palin red to black. So she, with a little white pearl. So, you know, she looks like, you know, Bush's mom. And this is only hotter and younger. So this is where American politics is now. This is the bar over which people have to jump now. Very high bar.
Since we're talking about jumping over a bar, I guess here's the problem for her is that she may be now a household word because of this ad, just like Sarah Palin has now become, you know, a mama grizzly and a household word. But just to let you know, an hour ago, everyone, 11:40 a.m. Eastern time, a new poll just came out because the only thing I really care about is how they're responding to her and to the ad in Delaware.
So what does it say,
Bonnie? It turns out that the poll shows O'Donnell trailing in the Delaware Senate race, right, that she is having tough trouble winning her own party. So she's got problems within her own party. Right now, Chris Coons, who is the Democrat, right, is beating her 53-36.
Right.
It is not going in the way she wants. But I don't think she wants to win. Can we be honest with everyone? I don't think she wants to win. If you look at how she arrived on the political scene, I'm going to recommend an article that you really need to look at. It's from Talking Points Memo. It has an article looking at how she started her campaign back in 2006. And it turns out that she had 22 appearances on Politically Incorrect before she became a household word, all right? And not only did she have 22 appearances, but this is how she was created as a political animal. She was an attractive college student at the Republican National Convention in 1992. A CNN producer saw her, very attractive, okay, started talking to her, very cute, very responsive, very bubbly, something you never saw at Republican conventions. Can we be honest? This is 1992. Usually they were like old women with blue hair and old men. So the CNN producer said, oh, wow, she's great. And what did he start to do but start to circulate this hot young Republican back in 1992, and we now know the rest of the story.
And that's
a problem.
Let's talk about the implications for the Republicans if she doesn't win, as the polls seem to indicate. Any chance, if she doesn't win, that the Republicans can take back the Senate, Stefan?
The conventional wisdom is that they need to win every race where they have a reasonable chance. But this is a year when I've talked to my colleagues who are political scientists. I have talked to people who do essentially pretty much statistical analysis of elections. And my colleagues say that if Christine O'Donnell doesn't win this race, that their chances are less, but that they have too many numbers that are soft for other races that they can't predict what the outcome will be. And so the chances of the Republicans gaining the House and Senate are still very good. And I've seen other analyses in which the projections are that if everything goes really well, they could take over the House and Senate by overwhelming and almost unbelievable numbers. So this is a year that is so unstable that Christine O'Donnell has apparently some secret intelligence information that the Chinese are going to take over the United States. That's the kind of year it is.
They already have. It's called Walmart. What are you talking about? But Ben, here is the problem for Republicans, and it's not just about losing the Delaware seat. And that is, if you are an independent voter and you are still somewhat soft, you know you want to throw the bums out, but the bums have a Republican name and a Democratic name. It's not that one party is better than the other, because you want to take a shower when it comes to both parties. Can we be honest here? And then you have someone like a Christine O'Donnell, who has risen, you know, to the top in Delaware as the nominee, despite whatever the Republican Party said, then what other candidates do is they run Christine O'Donnell as if she is a prototype Republican. This is what Republican leadership means.
And I agree with Arnie, Ben, I agree with Arnie that it was a big mistake for them to nationalize Christine O'Donnell.
And they
did. I mean, they've nationalized some other things, but, you know, they've got this new contract with America, you know, the pledge which the Republican leadership It's been overshadowed as a nationalizing the Republican Party by Christine O'Donnell and by some other things. And so in that sense, she is really very bad for the Republican Party because they're trying to create a national race that makes the Democrats defensive. That's a race about Obama and so on. And she's taken all the oxygen.
And makes it a race that also would not portray the Republicans as anti-intellectual.
Well, yeah.
Well, it doesn't give them policy heft. Yeah. If you are frightened about your future, if you are worried about your mortgage, your foreclosures, your job, your economy, China, the war, and Christine O'Donnell is the choice to be a U.S. senator from Delaware, and she's getting all this national notoriety, you have to start asking yourself, so what direction will this new majority take us? That's really what you have to start asking yourself.
Let's get away from Christine O'Donnell specifically, I want to ask you both quickly before we move on to the other numerous topics that we have this hour. The keys, in your opinion, to crafting a candidate's image from you as a political observer, Stefan, what if you had three things to tell someone about crafting a candidate's image, what would you tell them to be sure to do or not to do?
Well, I just had Senator Grassley in my class yesterday, and he is a perfect politician. What you do is you go after your constituency and talk to them and tell them about how they can trust you and tell them the things they want to hear. You go to the general public, as he did with my class, and you really never answer any questions, but you appear extremely knowledgeable and reasonable and centered, and you make you reassure people that you are going to solve their problems, that you're professional. You stay away from cornering yourself in a pocket where there is great intensity in the voters, but where the numbers are very thin. And I think that's the advice that you give people, is you don't allow yourself to be too much marked by the intensity of people who might vote for you, but instead you find where that magic number is of, 50% plus one, and you balance that out. And the other thing you do is you define your opponent before your opponent can define you. And in a lot of races in Iowa, for example, candidates didn't do that, and so they now are playing catch-up because they never defined their opponents early on, and I think that's one of the most critical things you can do.
Okay, Arnie, just a minute. I want to throw out to our listeners to get into our conversation. I want to ask our listeners the role that political ads play in your decision, Exchange listeners. Can you name a political ad that especially swayed you in favor or against a candidate from the past? 1-866-780-9100, the Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. And we're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Arnie Arneson, your views on the keys to a candidate's image.
Stefan, as a political science professor, and I have been a political science professor, and we've both been in the classroom, I understand what you were saying, and Grassley was the perfect person because he's got longevity and history, and we're talking Iowa. We're not talking the really angry states because Iowa is not one of those. But this is a very, very scary year, Ben. And the reason I say that is, when voters are having a tantrum, I don't know how you package. Mm. I don't know what you say, because it's all because they can't hear it. They can't hear it. I mean, let me give you an example. Wisconsin, of all places, that Russ Feingold should be, on the verge of being swept away in Wisconsin makes no sense. He voted against TARP. He voted against the war. All those things that you think are drivers that got people so angry, he did them. He did what they claimed they wanted. And it doesn't even matter because somehow he's there. It's the taint of being there. So you have that problem. But one more thing, you also have the problem because this year the amount of money that is pouring into campaigns from anonymous sources that are spending in some states $1 million a week anonymously against you, and the other side can't even claim that they own the message or they own the direction because technically they don't. How do you package yourself when you don't even know who the enemy is?
And the other, I would recommend an article real quickly in the New York Times by Matt Bai called Voters Disgust Isn't Only About Issues. And what he reports on is this focus group that a nonpartisan group did. And what they found was that voters really didn't care so much about politics, candidates, or anything else. they were extremely distressed about the state of American society. They were upset about the breakdown of civil society, the disappearance of common courtesy, the relentless stream of data from digital devices, the proliferation of lawsuits, and the insidious influence of the media on their children. And I can go on, but I won't. This article describes people who are not mad about policy, but they're mad about where the United States is as a society. And there is no politician who can do anything about that. That's really frightening, because people are just simply frustrated, angry, disheartened, demoralized about, for example, drivers who are hostile and inconsiderate, and teachers who can't discipline kids because the rules say that they can't even touch kids. People are just mad as hell about the place where American society has ended up in 2010. And that's a daunting challenge.
Stefan Schmidt with Arne Arneson today on our Politics Day program. Let's get some callers into the fray as well. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, Eric joining us from Dallas Center. Good afternoon, Eric. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good afternoon. You asked the question earlier about, you know, political ads and which ones affect us and what they make us think. I guess whenever I hear a political ad that says something, all it makes me want to do is research, because I always anticipate that I'm not getting any truth,
right.
if any, even half truth. So it gets me. Well, usually it's when my blood boils that I start.
Right. So a wise reaction there, because isn't it so, Arne and Stefan, that when you put the truthometer to most ads, they fall far short of what we consider the pure truth here, right?
I would love that caller to be my children's teacher.
Yeah.
No. I want my children to be taught by someone like you that says, because you read it on the internet, because you read it in the paper, because it comes on a blog, doesn't mean it's the truth, just the way that ad is not the truth. The ad is done to persuade, not to teach.
Eric.
Not to teach. And I want you to be a teacher, because if that's your reaction, then someone taught you very well.
Okay, Eric from Dallas Center, thank you very much. Let's go to Cedar Rapids, where Zachary is standing by. Hi, Zachary.
Hello. I was just going to say that I'm 23, and as a young voter, I feel that the majority of political ads that we see during elections seem to be targeted at people who have already made up their minds. They don't seem to be things that are influential rather than things that are driving home the same points that people already know.
So what's the purpose of spending so much money in making them and then broadcasting them, Zachary? What could be the purpose if they're already preaching to the choir?
I just think, I honestly don't know. It's
okay.
Just something that confuses me when I view them, because I tend to be more liberal, and when I see liberal ads, I'm like, yes, I already agree with this. And
okay.
When I see conservative ads, I think, no, I don't agree with this.
Okay, so
I can answer the question.
Yeah, Stefan Schmidt, go ahead.
I'll answer the question. A lot of negative campaign advertising, strangely enough and perversely enough, is actually intended to discourage people who are not very partisan and have them walk away disgusted and saying, I hate this. I don't know what to believe. These ads are confusing, and I'm just going to not vote. Because the parties don't like it when there are people mobilized and voting where they don't have a list of those people and know how they're going to vote. And there's been a lot of research done on it. A lot of negative campaign advertising is meant to essentially shake the tree so the sort of marginal fruit will fall off, and all that's left are predictable voters. And then you can drive them to the polls because you know who they are. You send them, you know, advanced early voting forms that they can fill out to get their ballot in the mail, which, you know, we've all been getting those forms. And that is very discouraging. You know, it's intended to mobilize the supporters and to drive away people who aren't that passionate about it and who can never get any good information from political ads, because they are intended to essentially be just negative. You know, they're not a briefing on anything.
Arne,
and let me also remind you that right now there's a tremendous amount of apathy on the side of Democratic voters. So part of the reason you're going to see ads that don't necessarily seem to reach but keep playing to the base is they keep wanting the base to show up. They're not afraid this isn't almost a persuasion of a new voter or, creating some sort of intellectual interest. This is about begging your historic voter, don't walk away. don't walk away.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem, especially from the more liberal Democratic side. Republicans already have the excitement factor. Mm-hmm. They just need to make sure they have the right numbers.
Okay, Zachary, I hope you had found several answers to your question there from Cedar Rapids. Thank you very much for calling 1-866-780-9100. I want to get to this quick bit of political news before we take a break at half past. This week, one of President's closest advisors, Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, announced he's leaving the White House to run for mayor of Chicago. Emanuel is known for his strategic mind, his sharp opinions, and, shall we say, colorful language. So what does this mean for the Obama administration, Arnie Arneson?
A friend of mine calls him Barack Obama's Dick Cheney. I think there are a lot of liberal Democrats going, well, it couldn't have happened sooner.
Yeah.
And what does it mean? First of all, it's so typical. What is the average stay for a chief of staff? I think it's 2.5 years. And at least Rahm Emanuel has an excuse. He's running to, you know, he's leaving so he can run for mayor of Chicago, you know, a position he's always wanted, never thought it would happen, or at least open on his watch. So he's very excited about that. I am from the state of New Hampshire, where we had a former chief of staff named John Sununu. And I think he had to leave because he was doing some things that were sort of quasi impropriety, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was he didn't leave for a good reason. He left for a questionable reason.
So this is a good juncture for the Obama administration,
yes,
to chain hands, and
we'll have an
intermediate chief of staff, and then we wait till after the elections to reset.
Well, he needs a chief of staff that's going to reflect what the heck the Congress is going to look like, and no one knows yet. So this gives him an absolute perfect opportunity to pick the chief he needs, not the chief that he has.
Stephen,
and Rahm Emanuel. He may have actually gone in and twisted some arms in Congress and gotten some of the Obama legislation through, but I think Rahm Emanuel must have given Obama some very poor political advice, because Obama basically went into a deep sleep for the last 2 years after the election. He lost the public support. He lost the bully pulpit. He lost the young generation that he was supposed to mobilize with all of his tremendous amount of technology. And I think in the end, Rahm Emanuel really did not do Obama much of a favor, because he's leaving as, you know, I'm going to go and run for mayor of Chicago, and he's leaving an Obama who is frantically trying to regain ground. So I'm not sure that he did such a wonderful job.
But people are giving him a lot of credit for helping pass a lot of historic legislation, Stephen,
which Obama in the end may very well deeply, deeply regret, because there are a lot of people who say that Obama's troubles and the Democrats' troubles are largely because the agenda was so ambitious that health care reform, while some people may think it's wonderful, really gave the Republicans a giant club with which they've beaten up the Democrats, and that it may have been the wrong thing to do, because people really were concerned about only two things. One was jobs, two was Afghanistan.
And
those two things, if he had concentrated on them, he might have made some progress on. So I think history isn't going to be very kind to Rahm Emanuel, frankly.
I think, Stefan, it's not that he didn't do remarkable things, Obama, as he addressed some huge, huge problems. The problem was they were never marketed. You just said that President Obama was asleep at the switch. Where was he? Too quiet, not involved, seemed not approachable. This is the man who created so much hope in the electorate and then suddenly becomes almost translucent.
Quickly, Arnie. Quickly.
A year and a half. And that, I think, is part of Emanuel's problem. But there are other things, too. I think we can't walk away from this.
Okay, we'll be back with Arnie Arneson and Stephen Schmidt talking more politics on this Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. When we come back, we want to talk about hearing political speeches from the pulpit. Have you heard it from a pulpit? Do you think it's okay or out of line for a pastor to preach politics from the pulpit? When we come back, we'll talk about the battle lines that have been drawn in a Sioux City church case. When we come back, and we want you to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Day here on The Exchange. Tomorrow on this program, more politics, a conversation with 1st District Congressman Bruce Braley. The Democrat is seeking re-election to his third term. Also on the program tomorrow, his opponent, Republican challenger Ben Lang. And that's tomorrow, Thursday, on The Exchange. Today, Politics Day, Wednesday, as always, some analysis on recent political developments, and a chance for you to tell us what's on your political mind. Joining us today, Iowa State University Professor of Political Science, Stephen Schmidt, along with New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. And we want to move on to a case going on in western Iowa. The battle lines are drawn between the Reverend Kerry Gordon, an associate pastor with Cornerstone World Outreach in Sioux City, and the IRS. Reverend Gordon is standing his ground in his statewide campaign to oust three Iowa Supreme Court justices in the November 2nd retention vote. One problem, the church's tax-exempt status prohibits him from making overt contributions or public declarations in support of or against any candidate. If the IRS investigates Cornerstone and determines that it has indeed violated federal law, it could take the unusual step of stripping the church of its tax-exempt status. And we want to reach out to our listeners in this portion of the program to ask if you've heard political speeches from a pulpit that you've heard from recently. Do you think it's okay or out of line for a pastor to preach politics? Is it a violation of the separation between church and state? Or, as Reverend Gordon says, is the current IRS code a violation of the First Amendment? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Stephen Schmidt, if I could go to you first of all. We know that churches have been heavily involved in politics for many years now. We remember Pat Robertson's run for the presidency in 1988. He, in fact, took second place in the Iowa caucuses ahead of George Bush Sr., as a matter of fact. So what makes this case different?
I don't think it makes it different. Whenever a church becomes involved in advocating sort of political initiatives, such as in Iowa, the repeal or not re-electing or recertifying the three Supreme Court judges of the Iowa court, groups who find that objectionable will file a lawsuit. I don't remember that Barack Obama's church in Chicago had ever had their tax status denied, even though when we saw the some of the preachings of the ministers and priests in that church, that they were extremely political. I don't remember that Martin Luther King or the Reverend Lowry, whom I knew very well at Columbia University, who were preaching from the pulpit about civil rights. And they clearly were preaching about civil rights, but also profoundly about politics. They were beaten and kind of persecuted and put on the FBI list, but I don't remember that the Internal Revenue Service yanked their tax-free status. Mm-hmm. We have a church, two churches here in Ames, Iowa, in Story County, that are going to have a remote satellite voting in their church. It's going to be on a Sunday when they have services in the church. Both of these churches are mega churches, huge, giant churches. And there is a big brouhaha over that issue because these are very conservative evangelical churches. And to have satellite voting there on Sunday when all the parishioners are there, it's likely to produce a very conservative outcome. So is that going to disqualify those churches because that is sort of mixing politics with religion? And, of course, it was the county auditor who placed those voting machines there on those two Sundays. So the civil authorities are involved in that. It's a very complex case, and it's very interesting. Of course, this case is entirely about gay marriage. I mean, this has nothing really to do much about religion and politics and so on. The whole thing is about gay marriage, getting rid of gay marriage in Iowa, which the Iowa Supreme Court validated.
Okay, Arnie Arneson, can you tell us anything more about what constitutes the church crossing a line into too overtly political territory?
Stephen, you know what you just said is true, but not accurate as it applies to this church and the 1,000 churches he's trying to reach out to. And what I understand is that he sent a letter out to 1,000 churches in Iowa. 100 churches have responded. They are not talking about politics. They're not talking about gay marriage. They are talking about three judges that are seeking retention. They are talking about them by name. They are telling people how to vote. They are specific, not in the policy, but in the particular individual that is running. That is where they have gone beyond the pale here. And here's my theory. You know the old line, pay to play? You can do whatever you want in your church. You can talk about every candidate, Barack Obama, George Bush, Sarah Palin. You can invite the witch, Chris O'Donnell. But what you have to do is you have to pay to do it. That means you lose your tax-exempt status. If you want to be a player in how we elect people, then you have to pay to do it. Because all of us pay. We pay our FICA, we pay our sales taxes, we pay something in order to play. And that is why they can do whatever they want. There's no free speech limit here, but there is a limit that says you've got to pay.
Okay, we want to get to opinions of our exchange listeners. What do you think about this topic, exchange listeners? 1-866-780-9100. The exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, Dave is in Cedar Rapids joining us first of all. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Listen, I just wanted to comment, and I apologize for not catching the names of your guests, but I was in my car, and I just...
Arnie Arneson and Stefan Schmidt are with us today. We're so glad to have them.
Well, Arnie's comments about the speech of Martin Luther King and the Reverend Wright of Chicago being a political speech is, I think, grossly a gross distortion of the facts. I think it's one thing to talk about civil rights and certainly take any position you want. And as a former pastor and minister, I've done that. But it's quite a different thing to endorse specific ballot initiatives or politicians by name under the context of there being a religious unction to do the right or wrong thing by either voting for or against them. And I think that is where the right wing, and trust me, I'm a member of a conservative evangelical congregation and have been a part of evangelical politics for many, many years, but I've come to the conclusion that our branch of Christianity has stepped way over the line here, that this is, in fact, to the detriment of our Constitution and our sovereignty as a nation, and unless the IRS does take dramatic action to correct this problem, we're going to be in some serious trouble.
Okay, Dave, as a former pastor, where do you draw the line that makes sense for you with your experiences?
I think I just mentioned it. I can talk about any aspect of gay marriage, homosexuality, civil rights, any attribute of the biblical perspective on this or of Scripture, but I cross the line when I specifically endorse a political initiative or a politician who, in my view, represents the view I think that should be held.
Okay, Dave, let's get a response from Stefan Schmidt.
Well, I wanted to ask the pastor a question, if I could. And that is, as a pastor, do you pay taxes?
No, I do.
You pay income tax. Yeah, pay income. So if you're speaking as a pastor, then you and not representing necessarily the church, but as pastor, you know, as you as a pastor.
Excuse me, Arnie. I am representing
it's
the
Stefan.
Church.
That's Stefan.
It's Stefan. Arnie's a girl.
Arnie's a girl. Stefan is a boy.
You agree with me. You agree with me. You don't agree with Stefan.
That's right.
I do very much agree with you.
You do.
I do. Yeah.
Yep. And we'll see what happens. We'll see how this whole thing turns out.
But please, let's visit your distortion for a moment. I am not representing myself when I'm behind the pulpit on Sunday morning at my church.
Exactly.
I am representing the church. And to try to distort that into anything that it's not is just that. I mean, it's letting two twists in the wind. And I think it's time that we start to defend the wisdom. And, you know, it's funny, I hear so much about the defense of the Constitution from the religious right, and yet, to me, this is the single issue which trods most heavily and egregiously against our Constitution.
Dave from Cedar Rapids, thank you for making your point today. And, Stefan, before we move on, any words there?
It is not in the interest of conservatives to have religion politicized and then give excuses for non-conservatives to basically suppress conservative churches. And I know that a lot of conservative pastors are very worried and believe that the separation of church and state is vital for the survival of independent religion in the United States, as much for conservatives as it is for anyone else. So, yes, this church is treading on ground that may be outside the circle that has been drawn, and we'll have to see how that comes out, because that circle grows and shrinks, you know, it expands and contracts, and we have various conservative courts right now who may go to the Constitution and find that the separation of church and state really is not in the Constitution in a manner as clearly spelled out as we believe it is today, or a lot of us believe it is today.
Ben, may I make one parting shot? And
sure.
This is going to make me, I start to shake when I even think about it. But I am still reeling from the Citizens United case that gave corporations unlimited access to the political sphere to do things in ways we never envisioned, because they're not a real person. But they are a tax-paying participant in the United States. And part of the rationale for their political speech and their ability to speak and all this stuff that the court was able to give them was in part because they were imbued with these quasi-personhood things, but they also were players in this country. They paid taxes. Therefore, they had a right to have some sort of impact on that political decision. This is the problem with the church. The church can do it. They can speak all they want from every pulpit they want, but they can't be tax exempt.
Yeah, but Arnie, remember that everything that we're talking about here is elastic and flexible. It changes, it grows, it morphs. The United States is a very young country. All the things that we're talking about now are the practices that we have become accustomed to, that we like, that we feel are very, very important. But in fact, it can change over time. You know, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion is the only thing it says in the Constitution in terms of religion. So Congress cannot pass a law that makes, you know, the Episcopal Church the official church in the United States. Everything after that is man and woman made. These are all laws that are passed by Congress. They are all internal revenue codes.
So they're all things that
we have created, and therefore there are things that can also be essentially changed and amended.
Go back to what you just said, that maybe we have enhanced the church by allowing them this tax-exempt status. Maybe we should never have done that,
exactly.
Because that's a way of embracing and enhancing them.
Exactly.
So that you may go back to the Founding Fathers and say, well, then, you know what? We just look the other way.
Okay,
you own land, you pay.
Let's go to Rachel in Iowa City to get into this feisty debate. Rachel wants to say something. I'm getting an edge in here for you, Rachel, so that you can have a word as well. Rachel, are you there?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Well, when I was in Iowa City, Lincoln, Nebraska, back in 2004, when the gay marriage thing was on the agenda, I went to an evangelical church, and that day that I went, I'd never really gone to one that I thought would be interesting, and on two large screen televisions, they had a message from George W. Bush, and then the pastor encouraged everyone to get out and vote. And I just found that to be grossly inappropriate. And the thing that's just scary about churches when they get into, and it doesn't matter what religion you are, people come from a place of deep conviction where it's not just like, from a more secular view, if I disagree with you, you disagree with me, we understand that we disagree. When you come from a point of view where you're like, gays, the Bible says to kill them. You know, there's something deeper and almost more menacing about it when a church is taking a position on something. I know sometimes it does positive things, like the civil rights movements, even though there were churches that were also using the Bible to say, you know, blacks were beneath us. But I find that within a lot of the evangelical churches, and I have a lot of friends in the community, my family's evangelical. That happens.
Rachel, thank you for sharing that experience and your opinion, and we want to move on. We have one more thing on our docket. We'll have to revisit this in a future show because
this is a hot issue.
It is definitely a hot issue.
And it's our
issue.
Future. It is our future. We need to talk about it.
We'll come back to religion and politics, that volatile mix, on a future show. But right now we want to get to the very last thing on our docket. On Monday, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie rallied conservative activists here in Iowa. He said his success as a Republican in a Democratic state shows his tough-talking, smaller government message resonates with all voters. Christie also fanned speculation that he's considering the 2012 presidential bid when he spoke to about 700 people. This was at a fundraiser for former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad. Here is Governor Christie at that campaign event warning Republicans that they have to deliver on campaign promises after the midterm election.
If we don't put up, if we don't perform this time, the public is going to send us to the wilderness, and they're going to send us there for a long time, and we're going to deserve to be sent because they're tired of being disappointed. They're tired of hearing politicians tell them one thing and do another. They want you, even if it's painful, to stand up and tell them the truth.
Governor Chris Christie earlier this week speaking in Iowa. at a fundraiser for former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, of course, running against Governor Culver. Not a name many people know in Iowa, Stephen Schmidt. Tell us about Chris Christie.
Chris Christie, you know, to become a Republican governor in a essentially one of those effete liberal East Coast states is a pretty good accomplishment. And therefore, he immediately bounced to national status. He's kind of no-frills governor. He's not slim and trim and jogs and, you know, jumps out of airplanes. He's a hard worker. Most people don't know him, which for him is a fantastic thing because he can come and let people, you know, paint in the colors that he wants. He raised more money for Branstad in that one event than Branstad has raised in any other events, which is interesting. The fact that he's coming to Iowa, among other places, but Iowa doesn't necessarily mean that he's interested in running for president. On the other hand, I know for sure that in his heart he is lusting after something more than governor of New Jersey, which is, you know, a very difficult place to be. And the Republicans are looking for someone for 2012. And, you know, the alarm bells are going off that, Chris Christie is a guy who may be competitive. And so, you know, he's been tough, kicked around teachers' unions, cut budgets, is going in with his sleeves rolled up and reorganizing that swamp of New Jersey and draining some of it. And if he comes out of there alive, then he will have in 2 years a lot on his resume to say, I straightened out one of those you know, blue states that had been mismanaged for a long time, and I'm improving education and am trying to balance the budget and getting things back in order. And you know, we know that governors make the best presidential candidates because they can say, I've got executive experience.
Arnie Arneson, what's your take on Chris Christie?
His point is well taken. The reason why governors make great candidates for president is that they have been one of one. The problem with the U.S. Senate, there are 100 egos in the U.S. Senate all imagining that they should be president, and none of them have led anything, let alone their office, because their chief of staff runs their office. So governors have a track record. Governors understand the word performance. They must perform on the job. And the problem with senators and members of Congress is they have to perform nothing. Nothing. Because they don't have to own anything, because they can hide behind a vote, they can hide behind an amendment, they can look at something else, they can look at a veto, and governors are in a position, which is one of the reasons why Chris Christie, I think, is interesting. The other thing is, I mean, to me, he reminds me of your plain wool coat. You know, it covers you, it does what you need it to do, it ain't flashy. I mean, this is a guy who doesn't even live in the governor's mansion.
He described described former President Ronald Reagan as the last truly successful Republican political leader in his speech in Des Moines because he stuck to basic core principles. That's what he said we need today. Now, has the GOP found their Obama for 2012? Could it be Chris Christie?
That's pushing it. But I mean, we here's the lovely thing for Republicans is they don't know who they are yet. So the reason why Chris Christie is doing anything like putting his toe in the water is that he too is trying to figure out where the country and the party is going, because right now the party is a party of no, and Chris Christie understands that governing matters. Why? Because he's been a governor.
Okay, in these last 2 minutes, I want to put you two on the spot and have you speculate a little bit. Each of you, who would you put your money on for the 2012 GOP nominee at this point, 2 years out? Can I go to you first, Stephen?
Oh Lord! Now you've put me on the spot. I'm thinking Christie will be very competitive. So as long as he makes a little ad that says that he's not a witch.
All right. What about you, Arnie? If you could be an advisor.
If they both weren't from the East Coast, I'd say that someone in the sort of Chris Christie mold, and believe it or not, a Scott Brown.
Yeah. Scott Brown.
And Scott Brown is such an interesting character. And, you know, he has the attractiveness of Sarah Palin. He's easy on the eyes. And I'm going to say that since they've been saying that about Sarah for so long. But he's also, he understands this very interesting art of both triangulation, which is a Clinton art that was very successful for Bill Clinton, and yet he does it from the Republican perspective. He's won out east. He understands the ley of land. He's a quick study. I think Scott Brown might be somewhere on the ticket.
Okay, and John Thune.
Okay,
the senator from South Dakota.
Yes.
All right,
yes.
You two.
She's terrific.
We have your words recorded. We're going to haunt you with them or praise you with them in future months. Thank you very much, Stefan Schmidt, Iowa State University Professor of Political Science. It's a pleasure to have you
on,
sir.
Ben.
New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Thank you for your feisty commentary as well.
Take care, Ben.
All right. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, we had help from Michael Yeager. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.